Good evening. Thank you for allowing me to be here, and I appreciate the prayer that my, thoughts would be clear and my words true. Typically, when the prayer before I get up is a ready recollection of the things prepared, my immediate thought is, but what if I've prepared is garbage? And that would not be good. So I appreciate the clarity and truth being what we want to come out. If you'll open up to Matthew 8, that will be our text here in just a little bit this evening. We're going to look at an excerpt from the life of Jesus in which I think Jesus experiences a common phenomenon that you and I experience a lot, and it's the concept of false expectations, of having a perception of the thing you're going to experience and then coming to find it being something different than what you thought. And I'll give you an example from mine and Stacy's life of the past year. We took a trip to Austin, and for those of you that are Texans know, for a certain generation, particularly my generation and younger, Austin is a holy site. It's like you get to travel to Jerusalem. All of my friends, when we graduated high school, they all wanted to go live in Austin. They wanted to go to school in Austin or just live there and work. And it was the place to go as if it had some sort of supernatural significance. And so finally, Stacey and I were going to go last year. And I'm expecting in my head, this place is going to be incredible. It is going to be a land flowing with donuts and bookstores. It's going to be the most perfect place on earth. And I get there, and, you know, okay, this is a city, like a lot of other cities. I didn't see what the big deal was. The perception in my head and what I had thought I was going to experience was not what reality bore out. Well, that's the case this evening with this encounter between Jesus and the Roman centurion. The centurion has evidently, as we'll see, heard some things about Jesus. The Galilean rumor mill is churning, and he knows there is this guy, Jesus of Nazareth, and there's something different and unique about him. So he does have somewhat of a grasp about Jesus. However, when he comes to actually meet him face to face, he finds out that he's quite a bit and startlingly different than what he thought. And I will just put this in our heads now, and we'll come back to it at the end. But for us just to be aware and cognizant of the danger that we face of having an expectation of what Jesus ought to be like, how he ought to act or behave or think, and then projecting that onto him. It's very easy to attempt to make Jesus into our image or think, well, if I was God, I would do X, Y, and Z, when in fact Jesus cannot be shrunk down to our box. So we'll go through this passage, hopefully not in unnecessary amount of detail, but try to unpack some things within it, and then ultimately come to an attempt to answer the question of who do we think Jesus is, and are we allowing Jesus to be himself rather than fashioned in our image. Let's read the text first. Matthew chapter 8, beginning in verse 5, says, "And when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him imploring him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, fearfully tormented.' Jesus said to him, 'Well, I will come and heal him.' But the centurion said, 'Lord, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another one, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it.' Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, 'Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness in that place, or in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.' And Jesus said to the centurion, 'Go, and it shall be done for you as you have believed.' And the servant was healed that very moment." A little bit of context to start us off, because we're jumping as Jesus' ministry has already begun to unfold and Matthew has already begun telling us about him. So some context will, I think, help us interpret this exchange between the two. Matthew has already set up, and Luke will do the same thing. It's significant to me that both Matthew and Luke place the story of the centurion after what we call the Sermon on the Mount, or Luke, the Sermon on the Plain. So there is evidently a connection, perhaps not just chronologically, but thematically, something that is meant to be mutually interpretive. So Matthew 5 through 7, we have what we call the Sermon on the Mount, in which Jesus has, in the longest block of teaching we have smushed together, expounded on the life of the kingdom, that if you're going to be his follower, you're going to be his disciple, it looks like Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And so he has bestowed on us this message of the Messiah and given us a full portrait of the life of someone following him. It then transitions in Matthew 8 from his message that he's preaching to then the mission that he's engaged in. And in Matthew 8, he will, I think this is paradigmatic of what he's doing, will cross three boundary lines, traditional boundary lines. He starts in Matthew 8 by crossing the a purity boundary by healing the leper. He then crosses, in our account, the ethnic boundary of a Jew doing this kind deed for a Gentile. And then it comes after that in verse 14, he crosses the gender barrier by healing Peter's mother-in-law. And that seems to be part of this larger program of what Jesus is engaged in. I don't think those are put together haphazardly. Matthew is showing us by having these events, and I think Jesus is guiding us in our development. If we are to live like Matthew 5 through 7, with all of the things that he will teach us in there, then it will work its way out into our lives like that. I mean, right before Matthew 7, he starts talking about the fruit that, or the tree that will bear good fruit, and that sort of internal dynamic works its way out externally, that they there cannot be a contradiction between those things. So this one account of Jesus' encounter with the centurion has to fit that larger narrative, right? It has to fit the message of 5 through 7, as well as the actions more broadly in chapter 8. So this encounter with the centurion needs to be consistent with what is around it. So then let's go to the centurion himself. So he comes to Jesus making a request in verse 6 about his servant. Let's establish a little bit about centurions, because I think it will draw out what is so startling about the exchange. The centurion is a member of the Roman army, though this was interesting in reading about it, and I think perhaps would make their relationship worse in some respects. A centurion, or the Roman soldiers, what we classify as Roman soldiers in Judea, were oftentimes not actual Romans. They would be pulled from the surrounding nations or parts of the empire, something more close to their home, which I don't know if that would make it more or less palatable for the Jews to deal with that. But either way, he is in service to the Roman Empire and to the emperor himself, having sworn an oath. He has a 20-year service contract. He will be a member of the Roman army for 20 years. When he completes that assignment, he graduates or retires into an upper class of the Roman society. So it's a way of climbing the ladder. He has under his leadership 100 soldiers, hence the name centurion. So he is someone of some importance, and he basically has two jobs. Job number one, collect the taxes, make sure those things are getting paid on time and in full. And second, make sure people remember Rome is in charge. He is a symbol of who actually runs the territory. You may have local leaders and whatever, but it's Rome and its army that is really in control, and he is a visual reminder of that. So it is this man of some standing that's come to Jesus asking about his servant. And in doing so, he shows an unusual amount of deference towards Jesus. He identifies Jesus twice in the passage, in both 6 and 7, by calling him Lord or Sir. He is not as what would have been his right in that sort of environment or system, for him simply to make demands of Jesus, for him to say, look, I'm in charge, I've got the military behind me, this is what you're going to do. And he doesn't do that. He comes to him and he calls him Lord. He shows some respect for Jesus, some acknowledgement of who he is, and that reveals something about the centurion's character. I think it's Luke's parallel where we find out that the centurion had done some things for the synagogue, had helped the Jews in their worship and things like that. So he seems to be a person who's concerned about the relationship between the Roman military and his Jews. He doesn't want to just exercise his authority. I thought about this, and going back over the passage, I have students who, they don't ask things of me, but they demand things of me. Like, Mr. Rogers, you need to give me some extra credit. And I'm like, you need to slow down. You're not the one with authority here. There's something of the centurion where he's recognizing a dynamic between him and Jesus that is different, and perhaps startlingly so. And so he asks, makes this request of his servant. He's tormented and paralyzed, and it's getting really rough, and he wants Jesus to do something about it. Which, not only is his description of Jesus odd to call him Lord, but so is his concern for his servant. In the Roman Empire, you didn't much care for your servants. They were considered property. Cato, the Roman writer, will, when he talks about slaves and servants that are sick or injured, he simply says to sell them off, right? They are cheap and replaceable. If it's not working, then get rid of it and get something that is working. In writings in Roman antiquity, they would describe slaves and servants in the same context that they would cattle. They are your property. They are to do your work. When they don't do their work, then you get rid of them and you find something that will. And yet here, he's not simply casting the servant aside, but he's going to Jesus. And he's saying, I would like you to heal my servant that is tormented. So this is a rather complex individual, the centurion. So then the responses, a bit of a back and forth in between Jesus and the centurion. Jesus says to him simply in verse 7, all right, I'll come and heal him. Right, your servant is paralyzed. I can do something about that. I'll be right there. You and I would expect Jesus to say that. We know Jesus well enough to think, well, he's in the business of healing people all the time. So this guy's come to him and said, my servant needs healing, and we know Jesus is going to do it. The crowd would not have had that that same response. It would be very odd for a Jewish prophet, much less the Jewish Messiah, to do something so favorable to a Roman, right? This guy is the enemy. This is the one who is taxing you, who is throwing your people in prison, who is governing you when he has no right, and it's not somebody that you're in the business of doing favors for, and yet Jesus simply tells him, all right, I'll be right there. The centurion then one-ups the oddity of response by telling Jesus, no, I don't want you to come to my house. I'm not worthy for you to come to my house. Again, the centurion knows something about Jesus. I don't want you to come to my house. What he may be referencing, and we don't quite know this from the text, but I think it's plausible, for a Jew to go into the house of a non-Jew, which would certainly be the case here, that house would be considered defiled and unclean, simply because they're not observing the law of Moses. That for the Jew to walk into that house would have instantly made him unclean. So the centurion says, I want you to heal my servant, at least that's implied. Jesus says, okay, I'll be right there. And the centurion knows enough about Jewish custom to say, that's not necessary. I don't want you to do that. That's going to make your life difficult. That's going to cause whatever murmurings from the crowd. I know that you can simply say something from across a distance and he will be healed. And to my knowledge, we don't find very many, if any, examples of that sort of healing in the ancient world. We have lots of stories about healings and chants and different rituals and people getting healed. We don't have stories of people healing across a distance. And yet the centurion thinks Jesus can do that. You simply need to say something and my servant will be fine. And it's verse 9 that I find the most fascinating and what draws me to the passage. Because he's going to reveal for us, the centurion is, what his justification is for thinking the way that he does. He says, for I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And I say to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. So now we get a glimpse of how the centurion perceives Jesus. Jesus is like a military commander, that there's a hierarchy. And so the orders flow down. And so Jesus has the ability, because of his station of authority, to give an order to what, I'm not sure. A spirit or a demon, or I'm not sure what the centurion envisions is going to happen. But that he could give an order and it must be followed on its way down. And so that's why he thinks the paralysis can be healed. And it's that assessment that I want to unpack a little bit. Because it says in verse 10, when Jesus hears that, he marvels. And I have traditionally interpreted that as a positive assessment, right? Here is a centurion of all people that would know these things about Jesus. And there's this amazement on the part of Jesus. I can't believe the centurion of all people knows who I am. That, yeah, I am this authority figure who says go and people go and says come and people come. And this guy is the one that's got me. However, the term amazed there is more complicated than that, because it could be used both positively and negatively. It could be an amazement that is positive, a positive surprise, or a negative surprise, depending on the context. Most often, though, and certainly in the New Testament, the usage is negative. And I'll give you a couple of these examples. We see the same term coming up in Matthew 22, in verse 22, where Jesus is being questioned about taxation, and they ask him, you know, do we need to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And there's a attempt on their part to trap him and cause him to alienate some portion of his following. And so Jesus gives the what has become a classic response of, well, whose face is on the coin? You render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God. And it says their response to him is that they are amazed at his answer. Given what we know about them, and given what we know about their intentions, and given what we know about their actions in helping Jesus get crucified, I do not think we should take their amazement there as, boy, isn't Jesus smart? Jesus really figured this whole thing out and answered our complex question. They are frustrated by the outcome that Jesus is still missing and eluding them somehow. Another example in Matthew's gospel where the term amazed is used, the same term, in the exchange between Jesus and Pilate in Matthew 27 and verse 14. So there, Pilate is questioning Jesus. You know, they've delivered you over. Are you the king of the Jews? Are you who they say you are? On and on and on. And Matthew tells us that Jesus remains silent. In response to Jesus' silence, it says Pilate was amazed. So what do we know about Pilate? Well, we know Pilate, in Luke 13, slaughtered a bunch of Galileans trying to give sacrifice. We know from extra-biblical writings like Josephus and Philo that Pilate was a brutal leader who had no problem killing people that upset him, who had no problem spitting in the eye of Jews, who did not care about their thoughts or their religious practices, who saw himself as superior. So then we come to the exchange with him and Jesus of Nazareth, and Jesus is silent, and Pilate is amazed. I do not think the proper interpretation of that is that he is really surprised and impressed by this Jewish man's chutzpah that he would not answer the Roman governor. He's frustrated and likely angry that Jesus would have the audacity to behave that way to him. Another example in the Gospels, our last one that we'll look at in this respect, the only other time it says Jesus is amazed is in Mark 6, when he goes back to Nazareth. And Jesus is going back to Nazareth, and he's proclaiming that he is fulfilling the plan of God and all of these things, and they reject him. And in response to their rejection, Mark tells us that Jesus was amazed. Hardly a positive assessment of Nazareth's beliefs. So then we have to contextually determine, though I think a priori, from the beginning, we would think it's a negative term, just by frequency of use, but have to be determined by context. So then contextually, does Matthew want us to think of this as a positive or a negative? And I submit to you that he wants us to think about it negatively. Because Matthew has already been setting up that Jesus is a different type of ruler and is not the same sort of ruler as a traditional military chain of command style leader. It's the same mistake that the centurion makes that the Pharisees make in Matthew 9, where they are attempting to determine how does Jesus exorcise demons, and they say that, well, he is a demon in a chain of other demons, and that's how he's able to do it, because he's up here, can give the order, and then the demons below him must follow it. So their perception of Jesus is oddly similar to the centurion's. But we know, I mean, Jesus rejects that understanding in Matthew 9. But furthermore, in the way Matthew has built the account, in Matthew 4, when we get our temptation narratives of Jesus, the culminating temptation is Jesus going up on the mountain, Satan saying, here's all the kingdoms of the world, bow the knee to me, bend the knee to me, and I will give you rule over all of these things. And I think what is at play there is a temptation given to Jesus of, you can be the ruler of the world, but it has to be like everyone else. It has to be in allegiance to Satan as one more member of a chain of command, and yet Jesus rejects that. But I think more determinative of a negative meaning is what we find in Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20, this is where James and John want the seats on either side of Jesus. They want the positions of rulership, and this is Jesus' response. And notice I underlined the words that are that have some similarities. But Jesus called to them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to be great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Now, I underline this part in 28 because that's not a do as I say, not as I do sort of command. The justification Jesus gives for living that way, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. So when Jesus is going to give an assessment of what does lordship mean, what does having authority mean, it is starkly different than what the centurion means. He uses the exact same terms, but brushes aside one conception for another of service. And we see this, I mean, throughout the Gospels in the New Testament. I mean, it fits very snugly with Philippians 2, where Paul will describe Jesus not desiring his equality with God as something to simply garner things from and to collect accolades and praise, but instead is incarnated and comes to serve ultimately through crucifixion. Or it's Jesus that says that it will be the first that shall be last and the last shall be first. So what does that sort of service and authority look like? Or it's Jesus that will say, if you're going to come follow me, you must become like a little child. There is a reversal there in which our conception of authority and leadership is radically subverted by Jesus. That it is not the way the Gentiles do it. It's not the way we typically do business in the kingdom of God. So then coming to the centurion, he's right in two respects, but crucially wrong in another. So he's right that Jesus is Lord. We have that as a frequent refrain through the New Testament, established through his resurrection. So he's right to call him Lord, and he's right to see that Jesus could heal. However, I think that he's wrong to envision Jesus as simply a commander in the mold of a imperial hierarchy. At this point, the question is perhaps raised in your minds, well, okay, if he is negatively assessing what the centurion says in verse 9, if he does not agree with that picture of himself, why then in verse 10 does he praise his faith? All right, if he marvels that the centurion could get him wrong, could assess him so incorrectly, why then praise him for his faith? I do not think it's because of his vision of Jesus as a military commander, but rather he praises his faith because he has an inordinate concern for his servant. That's what is so startling about the centurion. Because the centurion, without his own knowledge, because notice in verse 9, when he describes his interactions with his slaves, it's, I tell my slave to do this, and that guy does it. I am the one telling him how to behave. But here in this encounter in Matthew 8, the servant's at home suffering, and it's the centurion doing all of the work to go and bring healing to him. He now is becoming the servant for somebody lesser on the social ladder than him. And it's that Jesus points to and says, this guy's got it. Almost in spite of himself. This guy knows what it means, because what it means is to be a servant. To show love for someone else. This is opposed to saying, and this is why he perhaps draws the contrast between his faith and then the faith of those in Israel. Because when Jesus is going around healing on the Sabbath, the Pharisees at lots of different points are trying to pump the brakes and say, you shouldn't be doing that. They are missing this concept of service and love that would go to such extreme bounds to bring it. And so he concludes this passage with the centurion with this, again, a reversal. Not only the reversal of it is the centurion that now has become the servant, but that the children of Israel will find themselves cast out while those coming from east and west, a broad reference for Gentiles coming from all over, that they will be the ones that find themselves seated at the messianic banquet. You know, this great feast that we frequently have pictured in the prophets in which the Messiah will dine with his followers. So that it cannot be assumed on their part that simply because they can trace bloodline through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they have a guaranteed spot at the banquet. Rather, they have to look like the centurion looks right here. And the way that he is behaving, and the way that he is sacrificing, the way that he is showing love for someone else. So the centurion, based on rumors of Jesus, comes to a set of proper actions, even if a somewhat inadequate view of who Jesus is. So then a few lessons to draw from this. Two we'll hit sort of briefly, and then one we'll unpack a little bit further. We see Jesus here, what I think was vitally important in the first century, and then remains vitally important in the 21st century, is we see, not just here, but in several other places in the Gospels, Jesus exploding ethnic boundaries of certain divisions that were supposed to exist between, say, Jew and Gentile, between slave and free, between barbarian and civilized, that Jesus shows very little concern for those sorts of things. Here is a person who is suffering. Here is a human being made in the image of God, and that seems to be enough for Jesus. Not, well, tell me what country you're from, or tell me what language you speak, or tell me what about your bloodline. That it matters simply, he too was a person created by God. And that's something Paul will take and run frequently in his letters, how vitally important that was for the church, even in Ephesians 2 and 3, in which when he wants to describe the great mystery unpacked, that the great mystery unpacked is you have Jew and Gentile attending the same church. That's the great mystery of God. And we see that at play here in the ministry of Christ. And so for me and you, as people who will attempt to follow in the footsteps of the one we call Lord and Messiah, making sure that we are aware that ethnic boundaries still do exist and that we fight against them. Another one that I'll mention just briefly, this has typically been a passage used, and you can see this throughout church history, typically been a passage used to speak about Christians in the military. It was used by Augustine and Luther and Aquinas to say, well, when Jesus encounters the centurion, he doesn't tell him that he's wrong. He doesn't tell him that he shouldn't be a centurion. One, I think that's an argument from silence. And two, that would go, if the interpretation of verse 9 is correct that I've offered, it would kind of lean against that. But then finally, and perhaps most importantly, what is our picture of Jesus? I don't think we should assume we are above the centurion, and that while he could get some things about Jesus wrong, you and I have got it perfectly figured out. We know exactly who Jesus is, and we are completely comfortable with him, and we're perfectly fine. I mean, this is the central question. Who is Jesus? What more important question is there that we could ask of ourselves and answer? And this is what gets put forth in this encounter with the centurion. And so, what the centurion has done is he has taken what he knows of himself. Right? I'm a commander, I give orders, I'm a man of authority, so you too must be like me. And do we do that with Jesus? Well, Jesus must be like me in this respect, or Jesus must hate this because I hate it, or Jesus must want me to live this way because I want to live that way, rather than letting Jesus speak for himself. Do we attempt to make Jesus more comfortable to digest, and rather than letting him be shockingly counter to our expectations? And so then how do we guard against that? I think there's only one real solution, and it's to frequently confront ourselves with Jesus as he stands, to be in the text, to be reading about him, to be listening to him, to attempt to imitate his actions, and through a process of refinement there, we will hone our understanding. But again, that's that is a process, and who knows if we will come to some point down the line in which we do figure it all out. Probably not. We look in a glass darkly, and we wait for the resurrection. But we are continually at work to refine our understanding, and that we keep as central to who he is what he said back in Matthew 20. He is the servant who came to give his life, and that stands as central to who he is, that he is someone who came to bring healing, to serve, and to make the paralyzed walk again, to make the leper clean, and to make the dead rise. And that speaks to who he is, and that if we are going to follow him, if we're going to be his disciple, then that's what we have to be also, to be those who serve and be those who provide healing. It's very similar to John 21, in which you have the encounter between Jesus and Peter after the resurrection. And Peter's question to Jesus, "Do you love me?" We get that the three times, "Do you love me?" We get three times Peter saying, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And then each time, in variation, Jesus says, "Well, then go tend to my sheep." So that to love Jesus is to love and serve others. Those cannot be disconnected. We can't say, "Well, I love Jesus, but I don't like the church." That's a package deal. "I love Jesus, but I hate humanity." Too bad. It's a package deal. If we love Jesus, we will love those that are loved by him. And let's not miss the significance of verse 12. When he speaks about sons of the kingdom, he is not talking about some strange sinner out on the street corner that doesn't know about God, that flaunts the laws of God, that refuses to serve God. That's not his target. His target is the people who, if you said, "Are you a follower of God? Are you holy and righteous? Do you do what the Word of God says?" They would each say yes, yes, and yes. And it's those people that Jesus says, "But you've missed something crucial here." And it's people like me and you that he's warning there. People that consider themselves the people of God. But again, what fruit is being born? What sort of life is revealed through our discipleship? And that if we are to eat at the messianic banquet, if we are to be there in the presence of our Lord and King for eternity, it is done through a process of healing the world. And you don't have to spend very much time reading the internet or watching the news to see that there is a lot of healing that needs to take place. And will you and I say, "Here I am, Lord, send me. I know what your purpose is. I know who you are as the one who brings healing, and I will seek to do that in whatever small way possible." I am reminded through Matthew 8, as every time it feels like, I shouldn't say every time, at risk of hyperbole, but it feels like every time I go to the Gospels, I am startled by the Jesus that I find there. That I find something new and challenging that I need to follow, but also a figure that is deeply captivating. That to read the story of Jesus invigorates me, and it makes me want to know and follow him. Not simply as, you know, I teach history, and so I talk a lot about people that are long dead. Jesus is resurrected, but you know what I mean. And they're people that I know some things about, but I don't desire to know them. But when I am faced with Jesus in the Gospels, I want to know him personally. I want to not just know some things about him, some facts about the time that he lived or some of the things that he said, but I want to know him in the same way that I know my friends, the same way that I know my wife or my children, a deep sense of him as a part of who I am, guiding who I am. But it seems that to do that, there has to be first the identification of his lordship, of knowing who he is, of knowing the authority that has been given to him as he reigns over the world. And so I ask you this evening, in whatever form that would take, as those who have, you know, been his disciples, who are his disciples, who desire to be his disciples, to listen to his call and to understand his lordship, and to let him do what he came to do. to give his life a ransom, not just for the entire world, but for you as well. And if you need to respond, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing.